So cultivate and plant the seed. Hold your breath and count to ten. Just count to ten.
I don't know about you all, but that song gets me jacked up to do some more working out. Phil, I did a double today, but when I hear that song, I'm going to do some push-ups.
Push-ups, man? Why do you want to do push-ups for?
Get that chest pump.
Oh,
look good on camera.
Muscle Beach, huh?
That's right. You know, sun's out, guns out, brother. Tis the season.
All right, man.
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. Yourself?
I'm great. We're here with the Natural Born Hunter podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will Bradley, along with my co-host, Phil Big Sexy Mendoza. And our guest on the show tonight is Jordan Ross, a.k.a. J.P. Ross, a.k.a. the Grandmaster Fly Rod Maker of Upstate New York, a.k.a. the man, the myth, the legend behind Trout Power, as well as many charity events. Would they be volunteer events?
Yeah, and I'm also a male dancer. Got a couple awards for that, and a award-winning nude painter.
Now you paint nude or you paint
both
people nude?
Both. So sometimes at the same time.
You're painting nudes.
You know this is video. We're gonna have to get a sample of that before we cut
no problem.
Out.
Right? Okay. No problem. How are you? How you doing there, Phil?
Hey, man, JP. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Now,
nice to meet you too. So just to go back, yeah, I'm a fly rod builder and a strong advocate for clean water and wild trout. That is really what I am.
I'm sorry, JP. We're gonna have to go back on this one. Now, when you say we're gonna need a sample of this, do you mean you want to see JP nude, or you want to see the nude paintings he's painted while nude?
We don't want to discriminate against any of the potential female listeners. I think. Did you say? Are you married, JP?
Yeah, actually, my wife is here, and I was hoping she might actually talk a little bit about fishing too later. But she's happy with my hobbies. We can share. We're good.
There, you know, it's just display, right? We're just showing. We're not touching. Oh, so
yeah. Yeah, it's checking out
it's
the buffet.
It's all good.
That's a satisfied woman right there. So you are a fly rod builder. You also build accessories and things, gear, that ties into fly fishing in general, as well as running. You've run tournaments. You've organized creek cleanups, and your tournament isn't just a tournament as people would think of it. It also doubled as a creel study. And for those people out there who may not know what a creel study is, what is it?
Well, in traditional fishing terms, a creel is an object that you would keep on your side, and when you would catch fish, you'd put them in your creel. So the term creel study means you study the fish that you're catching. So when the DEC or any biologists do any kind of studies, on occasion they'll do what's called a creel study, which is essentially to interview and keep track of the catch that's happening in a body of water. So what we have done is we have teamed up with the New York State DEC and also with Cornell University to do some organized fishing tournaments and also monitor the fish catch and use that as data to try to collect information to understand what the habitat is like in the stream, how healthy the stream is, and get an idea of really what I guess we would call a baseline is for the stream. So, and when you throw money at it with a tournament, you get a lot more people. So we
what
take,
kind of sampling? I mean, are you measuring fish? You what are you doing as far as the actual study itself or the data?
Well, the Trout Power initiative that we started was based on two specific studies, Phil. One of them was to look at the water itself in West Canada Creek, which is where Will and I are, and to analyze the biomass that's in the water and essentially determine whether or not it's a good habitat for for fish and for wild fish and for fish to grow. And then the other part of the study in regards to the fish and monitoring the fish is how healthy they are, how long they are, how heavy they are, where they're located. Are they more distributed in one area versus another? And our main issue in our river here is, believe it or not, we don't catch a lot of small fish, which is an indication that the fish might not be spawning, and the only fish that you're really catching are the ones that the state is putting in the river. So the one study said the biomass and the clean water and everything is really good, which would suggest the fish should live by themselves. They don't need stocking. They should spawn. There's plenty of food. Everything should be just awesome. But when you actually do the creel study and examine what's being caught, there are no wild fish that are small that are being caught, which says that there might be an issue with the fish spawning in there. And that's kind of where we're at right now in this whole thing.
So there's not a chance that maybe everybody in your tournament's such an excellent fisherman, they're only fooling the big fish?
The data would suggest, based on the 2,300 some odd fish that have been caught over the three tournaments, that there has never been a fish that has been caught less than 6 inches. So, and the largest fish that have been caught have been consistently, this is odd, but consistently 23.5 seems to be the largest fish that we've caught, and it seems to be that way every time we have the tournament. 23.5 is kind of like the big size. So either when people say they catch a 26-incher, they either are, I don't know, stretching it or doing something. I don't doubt that there's a 26-inch fish in there, but the data would suggest that consistently a large fish in the river is 23.5. So if you get anything over 20, you're probably, which is in every stream, right, Phil? Anything over 20 is...
Hey. You're telling me that fishermen and hunters don't stretch the truth a little bit?
Phil, I know the only time you measure is when you stretch it.
No comment, Will. No comment.
All kidding aside, how important is it to the river's habitat to have – I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me that if fish aren't spawning, you know, we have a problem, because if people stop breeding – more people eventually. So how does this relate to, say, the West Canada Creek, which is in our neighborhood, and I'm sure this goes on all over the country? How, you know, what is it? What's going on out there? What's keeping the fish? Well, I mean, no one's getting them videos, or what's the deal?
There's kind of two questions there. One is, well, who gives a shit? I guess, right?
Yeah.
If the fish aren't spawning, so what? We'll just put more in. We'll the hatchery guys will come here and do it, and we pay our taxes and. So be it, right? The other side of it is, you know, my wife and I are very much into living in an environment and also being proponents of other areas in the world where you can coexist with an environment that you can enjoy as a conservationist, I would say, right? You can enjoy, you can hunt, you can fish, and the land is taking care of itself. I mean, I think a good example of this is like in the national parks when they took all the wolves away, right? The wolves are really bad. You know, they kill elk. They're a predator. People can't pet them. Get rid of them, right? But then over time, they found out that you need that for the ecosystem, for it to be a well-rounded ecosystem. We finally have come around in regards to national parks that we have that full, well-rounded ecosystem. Well, for streams and clean water, what we're saying is if it's really clean water, then it should have wild fish that are living in it and are reproducing in it. That's the indicator. Not necessarily, well, the water's clean and you can drink it. For us as advocates, we're saying, well, there's an old adage that if trout can live in it, you can probably drink it, which is pretty much true. A lot of old wise men would say that if it's a cold water trout stream, it's probably spring fed, you can drink it and it's fine. So the point is that that's an indicator for us that should be the next step in regards to clean water for people like ourselves, Will, that love the outdoors. You know, it's yes, it's clean, but it should also have wild fish in it.
Now, what are they doing to the water, I guess? I mean, do you know what they're doing to the water? Does anyone know what they're doing to the water that are keeping the fish from spawning? Or
There still isn't a red herring, so to speak, in regards to why the fish aren't successfully spawning or if they even are trying to spawn. I think our next big step in regards to drop power is trying to find fish that are attempting to spawn. So I think, you know, doing something in the fall and trying to do some kind of study where we actually capture fish and see that there's eggs in the fish and there's, you know, that they're able to spawn is probably the next step. There's nothing really that's indicating it. One hypothesis is, as the scientists are suggesting, is that because they raise and lower the water so much in order to make power, that even if the fish are successfully spawning, there's a very good chance that, let's say, they're spawning in 12 inches of water, and then the water changes either up or down. So let's say it goes from 12 to 18 or even 12 to 6. Even if the eggs are still covered with water, the oxygen content, the temperature, those things are all going to change. And for the eggs at in that early stage, that they probably are not making it because of that change in the environment that's so drastic, not just once, but sometimes three times a day. So, and we're not saying hydropower is bad. We're just saying that
the change in the water.
Yeah,
bad.
It's probably, you know, the flushing of the toilet, so to speak, to take care of on-demand power is an easy way to fix when you need more power. There's other ways to handle that. And all extremes in regards to engineering, anybody would say that, well, have a system that is consistently making power to handle both the surges and the low times. So what we're doing is, because we don't have a system that's well-balanced in regards to the power generation, when they need power, when everybody turns their AC unit on, when everybody turns their furnace on, well, all they do is they open up the pipe on the river, on the reservoir, let a bunch of water out. The water comes up 5-6 feet. They make a whole bunch of power. They sell it on the market because the grid needs more power, and we're good to go. And the other thing too, Will, is that they're doing this and it's going on the grid. They're not doing it necessarily for the people in our area, which is the other thing, is to say, if you manage our resources in our area for our area, we probably would never have to flush the toilet. We could probably just run the turbines all the time and make enough power for us all the time.
And by flush the toilet, you mean why don't we do this? Why don't you describe for the people out there who may never have heard of the West Canada Creek or been, you know, here to see it themselves, why don't you tell them a little bit about the river? Because you know, frankly, have spent a lot more time on it than I have.
To explain the river, the size of the river, it's in the stem that we're talking about here, and the West Canada is about 99 miles long when it comes out of the Adirondacks and drains down into the Mohawk River, which it meets in the town of Herkimer, and then the Mohawk flows into the Barge Canal, and then the Barge Canal flows down to the Hudson. Well, the section of the river that we're talking about here is anywhere from 50 to 100 yards wide. And in regards to flow of water, we have an average, I would say, about 1,500 to 2,000 or so cubic feet per second of water that's flowing through it right now. Well, what does that mean in regards to that number? Well, a small little stream that you might drive over when you're heading to work or going to church or whatever you're doing, a little stream that you probably could easily throw a rock over is probably going to be flowing at like 300, maybe 400 cubic feet per second. So we're up in the thousands.
Seems like a little bit more.
It's a lot more, yeah. So so in regards to its hydro resource, it's significant.
Now, a hydro resource, as we have on the West Canada, for those listening, is what?
The ability, when you can back up water and create a reservoir, a lot of water, and then drop it, okay, and use the force of gravity, that's called your head space. Okay, Phil, don't get excited. So the head space is the ability to use gravity so that you can drop it and you can turn a turbine. So if you don't have enough water to not only fill the reservoir when you drop it, which is what I call flushing the toilet, okay?
Right, right.
If you don't have enough water so that you can fill the basin back up, then that's an issue. The other thing is you have to have enough head space. You have to have enough drop so that when the water comes down from the force of gravity, it has enough inertia and momentum, so enough oomph so that it's going to turn the turbine. And in this case, we have there's three turbines on it. I think two are active. I don't quote me, but I think two are active. But I know there's three.
So, like you say, there's a great demand in power. Everyone's got their hair dryers on, their lights on. You know, if it's summer, they've turned on their ACs. There's a big demand for power on the grid. They got to meet that demand. They're going to flush that water down the hole, and it'll go down the creek where it changes the water level drastically and, boom, messes up with the fish's biological clock, we'll say.
Yeah, it also affects other things that people can recreate and do, kayaking, you know, swimming, wading, all that stuff. Whenever the water changes by a couple, you know, a foot, foot and a half, 2 feet, it's kind of a problem, you know, and it's dangerous. So whenever, I'm sure you guys have been on rivers and you see the signs, right? Danger, fast rising water. And you're like, what's this all about?
Yeah.
You know, it is dangerous. So, but I'm not, and again, I'm not trying to be an advocate saying don't make hydropower. I'm saying we should investigate the fact that if we just release the water at a steady rate,
right,
so that the turbines are always running, how much power can we make all the time, have a steady state,
store, you know, it per se.
Yeah, there's lots of things, there's lots of different things you can do. So
so you said that's one hypothesis as far as the water levels changing that are affecting the fish. Now let me ask you this, and I'm not bashing fly fishing or catching or any kind of fishing in general or catch and release, but do you think there's anything to maybe the fishermen not handling the fish properly when they're, you know, releasing them, that maybe it's causing some, you know, more fish to die? Or I don't know. Does that have any effect, you think?
Phil, are you trying to imply that the fishermen are giving the fish ED?
No. But I am saying that, you know, certain fish are more sensitive than others when you take them out of the water, when you handle them. And if they're not handled properly before they release back into the water, assuming they do get released back into the water,
right?
These are
very good points. And so let me rebuttal. The first thing I would say is we actually deployed temperature sensors in the river to determine how hot the river is getting, primarily because we wanted to see when they did let water out, what was it doing? Was it letting warm water out and that was going to be bad, or was it letting cold water out, which would be good? Out your way in Denver, all these cold water or tailwater fisheries, as they're called, are kind of good because they're bottom release from a reservoir, so they're very, very cold, which is a good thing. We generally don't have that in the east. But the point is that temperature is an indication that it's difficult to handle fish. So if the water is getting up to like 72, 73, and you catch a fish and you stress it, and then you try to release it, it's really not good. So the temperature data showed that actually the water was pretty, was not bad. It wasn't really cold, but it was not lethal. The other thing that we did is we actually did another campaign called Bucks for Browns, where we bought brown trout, we put tags in them, and they had numbers on them, and we put them in the river, and then we caught them. What we found, actually, was there was a number of fish that were caught not only within the same couple of days, but we had fish that were caught the same day multiple times within the same day. So there are instances showing that fish can be caught and released and live and be caught again. So it's very, very valid, everything that you're saying. And we can dismiss that it is possible to catch a fish, release it, and successfully and have it caught again. And we have data that suggests that that's possible on the West Canada Creek. So,
yeah, that's good to know. I mean, my fishing days have definitely been limited since I opened the pro shop here in Denver, but it's one of those, just I used to lake fish a lot, fly fish and lakes, and my uncle and I, who used to be the, you know, we would go out there quite a bit, we would hit some lakes where it was a two fish limit, and you know, I like to eat fish, but we would catch sometimes 8 to 20 fish each on the day on the lake, and we'd be releasing most of those, and it was always that thought in the back of my mind as to how careful do we need to be, you know, mm-hmm. with these fish.
Yeah.
And I just, that's good to know that that data, you know, with being able to tag them and find that out. I'm, that's,
well,
I know
it's,
that.
It, and it's, probably, if you guys are willing, and my wife Bobby's here, she could tell you a little bit too about her passion is catching tarpon in the Keys, and she's learned a lot in regards to tarpon and handling tarpon and how much they can take, and that those fish can be caught and released. And she's a big follower of the Tarpon Trust, and there are other fish that can't. I can tell you from experience that rainbow trout, for example, are a good example in the East Coast, that when the water gets warm and you release them, a lot of them will go belly up, like almost right away. You kind of got to like persuade them to turn around and go down. And then you're like, well, did they really make it? You know, I'm really not sure. Largemouth, smallmouth. I mean, you see these guys grab them and like, you know, practically chuck them into the water, you know, and they swim away and everything's good to go. So those are the Will Bradleys of the fish world, but just can't stop them.
No.
But so trout should be respected, I think, though, in regards to releasing them. I don't think, you know, there are times where the state actually has said don't trout fish because the water's too warm, and that's a good thing. So, but so
now let's I'm just gonna clarify this is I did not take part in any of these tournaments. I mean, if I had, I would have guaranteed fish under 6 inches would have been caught because I don't know if I've ever caught a fish over 6 inches on a fly rod. So you know.
Well, you would have won. One year it was smallest fish won, and we had so many fish caught that were like all cookie cutter 6 inches. It was probably a stupid idea, but
I've actually won a fishing tournament smallest fish category before.
Really?
Yeah, I have. That's the only prize I've ever won fishing.
Good for you.
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm good. I mean, I'm not saying I'm terrible. I'm just saying, you know, there's a lot of fish out there I cannot fool.
Well, you have won something. That's good.
Yes.
That's good.
My mom was very proud of that.
That's good.
So what's it like organizing these creel studies and tournaments? What's the hardest part for you doing it?
Well, once you put the plan together, it's fine. Usually the execution comes down to where you try to delegate it to other people or entities, businesses and media groups and things like that to try to do their part. And there's a lot of follow-up, making sure that they're doing everything. If I personally ever did one again, my wife Bobby has been a great help in the last one that we did. But I don't think that I personally would be like the judge or the referee or anything again.
Mm-hmm.
Being an organizer and then also being the judge, probably a bad thing. So that's lesson learned there.
Get a little backlash when you're the judge?
Yeah, it's just not. I just kind of want to start the thing and have a couple beers with my wife and watch everybody catch fish and just let somebody else deal with the crap at that point. But because there's the guys out there and gals that are like just having a good time, and then there's other ones that take it so serious, you know? So it's like, dude.
Oh, yeah.
You got to hire Will the Enforcer there to help you out when you need to
know.
There.
I know.
No seriousness allowed. So how did you get into fly fishing?
I don't remember how old I was, but it was before I had a car. Because I remember riding my bike down to the Dunham Public Library because I wanted to catch more fish, and I saw some commercial. I was watching Saturday morning cartoons, and there was some cartoon with this kid like went to the library and got a book, and then he started catching all these fish. You know,
any book, just any book you want.
It was a fishing book. It was a fishing book. Yeah. So like, you know, the premise was, you know, read books.
Gotcha.
And it really stuck with me because apparently I rode my little Huffy down to the public library, and I bought Ray Bergman's book on fly fishing, and I got a fly rod and started fishing, and I just didn't. I never looked back.
So it worked. It actually did work.
It did work.
Right.
It did work. It did work.
Well, good job, libraries.
So it was good. And then so I fished all through school, high school, and then I started drawing logos. Our J.P. Ross logo with the Celtic cross, and I started drawing that. I remember as a senior in high school and in study hall, and I kind of like had the sense already that it was going to be something I wanted to do. I wanted to have a fly rod company. I wanted to make great fly rods that were some of the best tools in the world. And so then at age 20, I'd saved up enough money to actually open my fly shop, and I ran that fly shop for 10 years and grew the fly rod company, what is now J.P. Rossi and Company, and grew that to the point where we were doing about 1,000 to 1,500 fly rods a year. Oof. We had 30 stores that were representing our product and selling our product all over the East Coast. And then it took another turning point where I got out of the retail side of having the storefront and was very much into materials. And mm-hmm. That's how, what I also do now as a material specialist in the electronics materials, but kept the fly rod business. And what I did is I took the fly rod company, which when it started was primarily just to make a fly rod that was affordable and custom. And now I have kind of grown it up to the point where we make, I would say, would you say, well, middle to high end,
yeah,
custom rods. We're not out of sight in regards to being like $1,000, but you know, 400 to 700 is a zone.
When I look at your fly rods, I wouldn't know it's not $1,000 fly rod. Let's put it that way.
Well, I appreciate that. That's kind of where we want to be, though. You know, we want people to look at it and think of it as an heirloom, but also want to get it dirty. Does that make sense?
That's exactly how I look at Phil. So
I'm speechless on that one, Will, so you just keep rolling, man.
I was looking for a response out of you. You're just shaking your head at me.
No. I'm leaving that one alone, man.
So you got into building fly rods.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us about some of your fly rods? Because people may or may not go to the website, and I actually enjoy going to the website and looking at them. You know, they look like the pictures you put up. They're like pieces of art in your hand. You know, and I said this in one of the posts I made. You know, it's where functionality and art meet is where I see your fly rods. You know, I'd hang these things on the wall just to look cool.
Yeah, I mean the design model of our rods is almost completely in line with the listeners out there that probably think about double barrel shotguns, right? So, you know, Parker's, Holland & Holland, all those really, really beautiful side-by-side shotguns are also these beautiful functional tools.
Yeah.
So that's what we try to do with our rods as well. With nickel silver, we blew the nickel silver specifically just to look like case coloring on guns. And I know you guys are a lot more into archery, but I'm sure you like guns too.
Oh, we like them all.
And you probably get my point. So the engraving, we do a lot of engraving with a lot of highly figured woods. But absolutely, hands down, they have to perform and function really well. So in the early 2000s, specifically J.P. Ross went right after the ESPN outdoor games and the outdoor games in general, and went into the casting tournaments, and we won a lot.
Really?
We won.
Tell us a little bit about that. Well, just skip over it. We won some huge, you know, tournaments and stuff.
We won in Isle Mirada. We won in Lake Placid, and then I think we came in second or something in Michigan, I think, was the other one that we did. But then
Michigan's a big one too, right?
Yeah, That was the big one. That was the one that was involved the casting and the fishing, and there was a flood, and the fishing was really – it was like a 6-inch rainbow that won the tournament, actually.
I could
– So you could have done that well.
Should have called me up. You know, 6-inch rainbows don't know about Will Bradley yet.
All those
other fish, they're on to me, but not those 6 inches and under.
So –
what's that tell you, Phil?
So the doing the tournaments did is it as you guys know, it first of all it forces it hones your skills, and it also helped us as fly rod builders and fly rod designers was to change our form and function a little bit, and also it really had to be good. Because we had a number of anglers and tournament casters that wanted our stuff. They saw what we were doing. It was a rod called the K357, named after, you know, like a 57 mag. So
what were you doing differently than other rod builders?
Listening. listening to the people that were casting them. So we made them specifically. They had to be stiff. They had to cast a lot of line, carry a lot of line in the air. So the tapers and the graphite that we used had to be stiff enough that it would do that, but not so high modulus graphite that they would be fragile and break. So.
And for those who, you know, may be listening and more into the archery side of things or the hunting side of things and not know what that achieves for your cast, what does that get the angler who's throwing out the line?
Well, I guess a good analogy would be when it comes to composites, when you take graphite, for example, and you bend it, it doesn't want to be bent. It wants to be straight.
Right.
So when you take a fly rod and you bend it when you're casting it, it wants to go back to a point of rest. It wants to go back straight. So when you have something that's a higher modulus graphite and stiffer, when you cast it and bend it, you have this extra reserve power in there. So the physics of it is like horsepower in a car. Okay.
So you're adding the horsepower.
You're adding the horsepower. You have to have enough horsepower in it so that, I guess if anybody's out there that races cars, they know that you can have a lot of horsepower but not be able to get it to the road, right? You can spin mm-hmm. your tires all day and never really hook up.
Right.
And essentially your car's slow with a lot of power. Well, you have to have a mix of that. You have to have a rod that is responsive. It feels good. It can cast a long line. It has a lot of extra power so that when you know, with your aggressive, you know, superhero nature, cast it. And then my wife also, with her beautiful, delicate, yet also strong and aggressive attitude, cast it. You both can still use it. So it has to kind of work for a lot of different applications and a lot of people.
A lot of different hands it has to work in.
Yeah, yeah. So.
So you won these tournaments. Did you ever notice maybe some of the bigger companies started taking note of what you were doing with your rods? And, you know,
yeah, we still are very respected. I know a lot of the people in at Sage and Scott and Hardy and all these Orvis, and we all get along very, very well. And yes, I think that we all learn from each other, and that's something that you get from any kind of high performance kind of sports. You know, NASCAR is a good example of that too. I mean, you guys can probably speak to this too, right? And the stuff that you guys do, when you go up and you see one particular company with one type of technology, if you're going to put it out there, other people are going to see it. They're going to witness it, and it's supposed to spawn, you know,
better
growth.
Products.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that definitely happens in the archery industry, and I'm sure Phil could name a few prime examples of where companies have really run that line of almost straight up stealing the other company's ideas.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of lawsuits that go on in the archery industry because of design, you know, but that's another topic for another day. But so when did you guys? You said you participated in these events. Is it something you no longer do, or is it something you just focused on for a certain time? I mean, where are you at now as far as that world?
That world kind of slowed down a little bit. I kind of put myself in the realm of being the designer and being the kind of the owner of the company, and I stayed behind the curtain a little bit and moved the levers and did everything that I could. There were other people that cast better than me that were the stars. And there's too many to mention, but there's a ton of great guys out there that had our stuff and cast our stuff. But what I did end up doing is for example, there was an outdoor tournament. I think it was through it was through Outdoor Life, if I'm not mistaken. It wasn't through ESPN, but Jack Daniels was the main sponsor, and I was asked to be a judge for that. So I judged that. So I kind of was in that realm of hanging around with the administrators and the suits, so to speak, in all the fly rod companies, and then there were stars like you guys that did the great stuff. So, but God forbid something broke and I was there, luckily I wasn't on camera to cry. So that's just good. Didn't happen much, but everybody broke stuff, and if you don't break things, you're not going fast, I guess. That's the way I think of it. So
I couldn't agree more.
You know, did you, so you think that time when you guys were maybe, I don't know if it was yourself or some of the other people, maybe a little heavily involved in the tournament or competition scene, really helped you guys in your growth, or at least your popularity and awareness to other people? Was that a good thing at that time?
Yeah, it was very good. It was very good. I mean, it helped us greatly in regards to our technology. Our technology was real. It proved that it was real, because we were winning stuff. People that were excellent casters would pick up our stuff and they would cast 120 feet, you know, and the proof's in the pudding. So you'd see them do it. Other people would see it do it. I'm not going to lie, our team was probably the wildest. So, and in regards to the nightlife and stuff, I don't think my guys ever really did a tournament completely sober. So,
so that could have been the real
that
secret.
Helped. I think the
stay loose.
The brand was very fun. You know, we were a fun group of guys in our 20s, but we had a lot of muscle in regards to our product was good. And that's a tough thing, I think, in the outdoor industry, is the smaller companies that have really good products, you hit a kind of a stage gate, so to speak, where you either get crushed because somebody crushes you that's got a big wallet, somebody consumes you because they realize you've got great stuff, and you end up becoming something else, and then it's fearful that you lose the kind of culture or edge that you had when you were a smaller company. And then other ones just take right off. I mean, you know, I think of some other outdoor products that just went absolutely apeshit, right? Yeti is a good example, right? I mean, I know a little bit of the background story behind Yeti, but then they had a lot of money behind it, but they came in and, you know, yeah. It's like, it's a cooler, man, you know?
Yeah.
And my wife's got three of them, you know, we'll probably get another one. Just the other day I was home and the box showed up and it was a special edition Seafoam green $300 lunchbox, you know.
Wait, did you buy that Seafoam green lunchbox?
I'm the husband, so ultimately I end up paying for everything. But she's happy, happy wife, happy life. But we have to have one, you know. And what are some things in archery, guys? There's got to be some little bit gimmicky things, but some stuff that's really taken off.
Oh, Phil's got a lot of coolers.
Sorry, I lost you for a second there, guys.
He said he asked what a couple of gimmicky things like that are in the archery world, and I guess it'd be archery and hunting world, but I mean, you can blow money so easily in archery that you don't need to.
But there's also a lot of companies that, you know, they've got great, really great products, and you almost kind of want them, like you wish they could take off, you know, like they need a little oomph behind them, and you got to have the right entrepreneur that takes it to that level.
Yeah, like there's a podcast I know about that I wish would just take off, but. Not yet. Maybe after the J.P. Ross episode.
Well, if
you
get my wife on here, I'm sure you'll get more people.
Heck yeah.
Well, if we get you dancing and her tipping you on camera, I think that's going to be the ticket.
I think records could be broken then.
Oh, boy.
Oh. Yeah. No, there definitely is a lot of products that, like you said, gimmicky maybe, good design, you know, great products, smaller companies that it's hard, you know. I mean, when I first opened my pro shop, our first big bow line was Elite. You know, that Matthews wouldn't sell to us, Hoyt wouldn't sell to us, and those are the bigger companies. And I tell you what, that year Elite had a bow that I put up against just about any other bow. So it was, we had to sell it harder. And so I've seen a lot of the products, and Elite now is huge. You know, they've definitely grown as one of those higher end companies, but anyway, there's a lot of that out there. I was more curious on the promotional side, or the you know, when you guys were ingrained into that, because when we were starting with my shop, we had a crew of guys that was out shooting all the tournaments locally and some regionally, and we were doing real well, and it put our name out on the map, if you will, from that perspective. And it's gotten harder to attend as many of those events just because things get busier. Mm-hmm. But I saw it as a valuable time also, not that we're done shooting, but a couple of the guys have already, you know, reached pro status. But when we were first coming out, we were kind of the same way. We were the, we showed up to one tournament, we got our new black jackets and everything, everybody walked in and it just kind of everybody stopped and looked at us like, you know, these guys mean business. And we did, mm-hmm. and we won a lot of stuff, but it was, I see on a smaller scale what we were doing, what sounded like what you guys did, and it it was, I saw it beneficially for us on the pro shop side. So that was interesting hearing you guys, you know, kind of dabbling on that bigger scene and making a mark, if you will, you know, I mean, putting a stamp on things.
Yeah, and I don't know, I apologize for not being in your industry as much as I am in fly fishing, but our industry right now is changing in regards to there's a fair amount of saturation of a lot of different stuff right now. So it's very easy to get stuff from Asia. It's with social media and things going on, it's getting kind of cool in regards to people to kind of put themselves out there, whether they're really legit or not. It doesn't almost matter as long as they get 1,000 people following them and they're posting a bunch of stuff out there. So it's a lot harder. It's just, it's funny how the world is, because like you think sooner or later it's like things are going to get easier, but it that really just doesn't. It, you know, more technology, more stuff, more people. It's friggin' hard. It's harder. Well,
you guys have fishing tournaments that are sponsored by Jack Daniels. Archery is probably about 3 to 5 years from getting something like that. So,
okay. You think it's 3 to 5 years, or you think it's like 10?
I don't know, man. I don't know.
And fly fishing is my God, is so far behind, you know, the bass fishing world. It's just not even, you can't even graph the two on the same same pie chart, because it's like, where's the fly fishing section? You know, it's all bass.
You know, that's funny you mentioned it, because I don't think Gander Mountain, our local Gander Mountain had a fly fishing section, and then Bass Pro Shop, they just put in one of the smaller stores. I think they call them outposts. Mm-hmm. And they had a fly fishing section. I went in there and my mind was blown. Like, whoa. Yeah. I didn't expect this.
No, I know. I know. But so would you guys mind if Bobby jumped on here and talked a little bit about maybe some saltwater fishing? You guys got
I don't mind at all. I just have a few more questions for you, though, if you don't mind. And then, because we're probably not going to want you back after we have her on here.
She's denying she won't do
it.
If you
had someone come in, or say somebody came to us and they're like, we're looking, I would like to get into fly fishing, where would you recommend they start?
Locally or in general?
Let's say in general. I guess we'll say locally first for any local listeners, and then go in general for, you know, the audience abroad.
Well, I think I probably could answer it in general now that I think about it. The way to start certainly is to try to find some people that will take you out and expose you to it, because it's very easy to be sensitized to the wrong things by just immediately going to a big box store. So I guess the same – A privately held fly shop is definitely the way to go to meet people. I wouldn't go big box. Phil, you've got a store, right? You know, guys speak the language. I don't know if you agree with me, but right?
100%.
Yeah, so, you know, keep it with the real guys, with the local guys, and get some ideas. It doesn't take long in regards to fly fishing and probably any outdoor sport that when you start to get in the circle – there are a lot of people that want to take you outside and show you and fish with you and shoot with you and do stuff. So that's kind of where I would go at it. Your gear too often is a reflection of what your discretionary income is, but you do have to have something that'll work and it's going to work well. And again, I think you'd have to take advice from somebody that has a private shop.
What would you say if you were to allocate, say, someone was like, all right, I got X amount of dollars, where is the most important places to put that money?
I would, if you're going to, around here in the Northeast, you're going to be a trout or a bass fisherman, you're going to need a rod, a reel, a line, fly box, something to hold your fly boxes and stuff, although you probably can put them in your cargo shorts or your cargo pants. Waders and wading boots, maybe. Mm-hmm. So I would say a $500 check could probably get you into all that stuff. Nice. If you just were gonna try to like go out on a canoe because you already have one, or you have a boat and you just want to catch some bass and bluegill and stuff, 250 is probably your zone in regards to mm-hmm. rod, reel, line, and some flies that you can throw in a medicine container, you know, pill container.
Yeah, yeah. If say someone was to come to you and say, "Hey, JP, I've been fishing for a long time, heard you on the show. Love the way your rods sound. I'd like to get a custom rod." Where do they start off with that?
Well, our website is jprossflyrods.com. The easier one to remember is smallstreamflyfishing.com. We've got both of those. And we have rods in our case that fit just what I was saying. So we have an Adams series that's around $200. You can get one of those. We got reels that are 39 on the site. Fly lines that are 30, and you're in pretty good shape. You got a rod that's made in the United States. It's going to have your name on it.
Ooh, I like things that have my name on it.
I've been to the site, man. Pictures are great.
Thanks.
It's very bright. I mean, when I first clicked on it, that's the first thing I noticed. It's like, man, these pictures are just, they tell a story, you know, with no words, and that's sometimes the best thing because it's, I don't know. I just compliment you on your website. I'm not going to go too far into that, but it's a very nice, presentation.
Website envy, Phil?
Yeah, man, it looked nice.
We've got a lot of skilled photographers that have given us pictures. I can't not mention them. Draper White and Matt Guyman are two people, and there's a couple other people that are coming on board also that are sharing stuff. But all the pictures that you see on there are from those two guys, and they're great guys, and they're very talented. You know, I take a lot of the pictures of the gear, but those, like you said, Phil, those shots of the fish in the net and the people casting in these beautiful places. And that's, I think, the cool thing about fly fishing is where you go to catch these fish, they tend to be in really beautiful places. So it's worth it.
Going back to the getting started, so let's start with, like, kids, right? I've got a 5-year-old son. If he's with dad, he's happy. And like I said, my fly rod and gear has been up in the shed for about 6.5-7 years. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to get him started in that. I just don't know. Is how young is too young? When is it? When you think is the right time to? Because I mean, as far as you know, spin reel fishing and yep. just bait fishing to get him started. That's kind of what we've done, but. 7, 8, I don't know. What do you think?
You certainly can go as young as 5. And I'll tell you what you do is you take the rod, you put the rod together, and you take an old fly line, you tie it to a paper clip, and you put that paper clip onto the last eyelet of the rod, and you have a little short fly line that's maybe about 10 feet long and a little leader, and you put a little fly on there to catch bluegill and sunfish and little panfish. And you get your little guy or girl out there and just flipping that thing out, you know, to catch the bluegill and stuff. And don't worry about the reel. Don't worry about their other hand or any of that other stuff. And those fish are eager to take a fly. And lots of times that little twitching and all the little things that kids do because they're so, you know, they don't want to just leave it, you know.
No.
They end up teasing those bluegills and crappy and stuff right to that fly. And then, you know, it's pretty easy for dad to just get them used to sliding that fish back so that you can release it and, you know, make sure you cut the barb off the hook, make sure he's got a hat on, make sure that he or she's got glasses on, and let them go. And they're going to get pricked. And if they don't get hooked, then they're not doing it enough.
So, it's good for them.
Yeah.
Just try to make sure they don't hook you, Phil, because that'll probably happen as well.
I've got a funny story, man. When I was real young, I don't know. I might have been 8 or 9 years old, big family reunion trip, and we're out fishing. And my family grew up kind of just bait fishing. So I've got this hook on my line, and I'm sitting there, like you said, just a little kid flinging it around. Well, this hook hooks my nose. And I felt it hook my nose. I have the rod in my hand. Well, I'm thinking it's hurting, so I'm pulling it further away from my arm, and it's hooking my nose deeper. So here I am screaming, running back to the campsite. With a hook in my nose, and it was funny because everybody was like, "Well, quit pulling it further." And you know, here I am, little kid, and I caught a big fish, man. I caught myself. But, so, yes, Will, I have hooked myself pretty good back in the day.
Pretty nose piercing.
Oh, it was rough. It hurt.
Oh, man.
Rocky, it didn't scar you for life, though.
No, but I still hear the story from my aunts and uncles about that time that I hooked my nose at camp. So it's good. So if I can get my son a story or two like that that he learns from and never forgets, that's worth it.
Yeah.
And for any of those archery guys out there who are interested in kind of wondering what fly fishing is like compared to, say, bait fishing, I would put it like this. Hunting with a rifle is more comparable to hunting with bait, and a bow and arrow are more alike a fly rod.
Right.
Because, you know, it's really that becomes part of your body sort of mentality that would cross over from the bow to the fly rod. You know, it's a very actively, how would you maybe describe that?
Well,
that
I think,
feeling?
Yeah, I think it's a lot more sensory.
Yes, you know? That's a great way.
There's you're much more intimate with the tool. So both archery and easy.
Will can restate that.
Not even going
make,
there, man.
We should make a shirt that says something like that.
I'm a fisherman. It'll just say I have a picture of a bow and a fly rod and on the back.
You got to have the both options, man. You got your fly rod, I'm intimate with my tool, and the bow, I'm intimate with my tool.
Yeah, I'm double fisting.
You know, this could have been turned into something really, really nice about how
eloquent.
But you know what? Forget it.
You said it. You should know better.
Yeah, I know.
So. Anyways, back to that. Back to, I would agree. It is an intimacy with your tool or weapon of choice that I think works as an extension of your body.
Yep, and as well as being, the way I used to explain it to people in regards to fly fishing is when you first start fly casting, and I've done a little bit with a bow, and I think that this is similar. It's funny, though, how this does not correlate with golf, which in my opinion is a waste of graphite. But when you start fly casting and you start using a bow and arrow, you're thinking a lot about what you're doing, and what ends up happening is you're like, when you're fly casting, you're thinking about your back cast, you're thinking about looking over, making sure that you're pausing long enough, you know. And I'm going through this teaching my wife a little bit right now, and I'm seeing it, that's like I'm doing it all over again. But what happens is you begin to develop this muscle memory, and you get in tune with the fly rod, and that portion of your brain that was thinking about where to stop on your back cast and how fast you should be going and all that stuff is now void of having to think. And what ends up happening is all the stuff that's going on in the environment fills that void. So hearing birds, hearing a tree snap, listening to the wind, listening to the water, sensing the water, all those things are like accelerated because you were used to using your brain to think about how to cast, and now it's used to think about and absorb the environment. And I think that's why people that get into fly fishing, that really get into it, stay with it for a long time. And it's a great sport. It's a great way to be in the woods because you can do it for so many years, you know, playing football and doing all this stuff. Even as nuts as you are, Will, with all the stuff that you do, you know, in fitness, you're not going to be doing that when you're 80.
Oh, yes, I will be.
Not looking like you do now.
No, I'll probably look better. No, I'm really, like fine wine.
Yeah,
I'm telling you. The thing about archery, and I would agree 100% with, is when you're starting out, the amount of thought and you know, your mental process that goes into getting that muscle memory down with, you know, all your stance, your following through, your release, all that timing, all that stuff that goes into it. Once you finally get it down to where it's committed and your muscles know what to do without you having to constantly consciously think about it, you can focus on where that arrow needs to go, you know, where you're aiming, you know, and let everything else just kind of take care of itself. And this touches on when I was starting to learn to fly fish. I went with a good friend of JP and mine, Lighter Doolittle, who was one of my grandfather's best friends, and he taught me to clean a gun. He's taught me to fly fish. A great guy, great outdoorsman. And when I'm out there, I have to spend so much time constantly focusing on, you know, my back cast, everything, all the timing, all that. You know, I'm maybe catching 1 or 2 6-inch you know, rainbows when we're going out. Meanwhile, he's over there looking like a samurai with a rod, catching these monstrous trout. Doesn't look like he's doing anything. Yeah. You'll see one little thing drop. Next thing you know, it's like there's, you know, the fly drops right there. Boom, fish. Up, catch it, release. Boom, another fish. You know, and I'm over there trying to do everything I can just to not hook myself in the nose like Phil. And you know, he's just doing it effortlessly. And the guy's, you know, I think mid to late 80s now, and he's just outfishing me like no comparison.
Yeah. So JP, where's your – I mean, what's your favorite type of fish to catch, and where is that at? I mean, what –
Oh,
geographically,
I would say I'm going to give you three things. I'm going to give you the best, the most enjoyable, and where I want to go, I guess, or what I want to do before I die. But Adirondack streams right here in our backyard in the Adirondacks, catching brook trout, wild brook trout is what I love to do. I love to keep it simple. You know, our motto is Simply Fish. I like to just put on some boots or Tevas or whatever, wet wade, go find a stream, and catch wild brook trout and do that. I have now expanded that where I'm doing everything in the Adirondacks with my wife, watching her do this, and, you know, it's very enjoyable to do that with her. So the Adirondacks and brook trout would be what I enjoy the most in regards to growing up and who I am right now. The passion lately has been the Florida Keys, hands down. My wife and I love going down there. Bobby and I go there as much as we can. We love going after tarpon, catching tarpon. We love snook, redfish, bonefish, any kind of it's just great down there. And it's so the conservation mindedness in regards to that place is just it's just awesome. I mean, you don't have to – you don't even have to talk about it because everybody's like – somebody comes to the dock and they got a bunch of dead fish in there and they're like too small to even eat. They get almost laughed off the dock, you know. So it's just because everybody – that's just how everybody is. So we just love it there. And I would say my wife and I would probably say that our next big adventure will probably be venturing out your way. Phil, you know, Yosemite, Mariposa, certainly up in Oregon and up that way, you know, the redwoods and catching fish out there and experiencing that is probably our next big adventure. Wild cutthroat, golden trout, they seem like the next notch on our belt that is gonna that we're gonna put. So
why don't we get your wife on to say a few things? I mean, I've loved to meet her and get her take on.
Yeah, Bobby, come on
here,
over.
Bobby, just
it's too late. Phil's invited you on. It would be rude to say no.
Come on, Bobby.
I've never fly fishing.
Come on, get over here.
I've never caught anything.
Well, do I have to?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm not doing anything here.
Just one question. Just tell her. Just one question
about catching fishing. No.
You would be our first female guest on the show.
Bobby, come on, please.
The show's kind of a sausage fest.
Hey, it has been.
Bobby, get over here.
Come on. You don't want to come on?
I'm not good at those kind of things.
Come, We don't have time. Come on. Hurry
she
up.
Just has to answer a question. Just ask her just one question.
Okay. Phil's just
Phil,
got one
Phil
question.
Phil just wants to ask you one question. So just come over and look over my shoulder, okay?
Come on. There we go. She's coming over.
Okay. Just put these on and she can hear him.
Bobby Ross, everybody.
Hello, Bobby. Can you hear?
Yes, I can hear you.
Welcome to the okay, show.
Thank you.
Welcome. So just one question. I mean, my wife and I, we love being outdoors. And if she's, you know, hopefully I can get her to listen to the show. But what would you say as far as sharing this kind of activity with your spouse? I mean, what do you take from it? What do you get from it? And what kind of enjoyment? And where does it put you? Where do you put it on your list of things you look forward to do?
Well, definitely, I never fly fished before I met my husband, so he's been trying to teach me, and fishing's always been my passion before I even met him, even when I was little. My father, who was in heaven, taught me, you know, the roots of, you know, just fishing and just loving the outdoors and the wilderness. So basically, fly fishing, actually, it's like Jordan said, it's more intimate, you know. Like, I shoot guns, too. I've never done any archery like you guys, but it's just you have to be more in tune with your body. And actually, when you catch that first fish alone, when you learn to fly fish, it's amazing.
Yeah, and I got to experience that by the help of my uncle, who also played a big role in teaching me a lot about hunting. So no, that's kind of what I wanted. I don't, you know, I appreciate you coming on, and I think that it is just like archery, a family type of activity where I've got two young boys, and I'm planning on I've started teaching the older one, you know, archery, and fly fishing is definitely next on the list. So hearing, you know, yourself and JP being so active and not just from the product standpoint, but just experience it and living what you do, you know, that's great to hear. And so what about you? Where's your favorite place to fish, or what's your favorite fish, you know, to pursue?
My favorite place to fish is in the Florida Keys in Isla Mirada. I gravitate to the ocean. My father's ashes are in the ocean. He used to ocean fish. And we just love catching tarpon. Tarpon are amazing fish. They jump out of the water. They give you one hell of a fight. It's just amazing when you have one on. It's gets your adrenaline pumping. It's just amazing.
So it's definitely a tarpon's a bigger fish, bigger gear that you're using for this type of fly fish. Am I right?
Yes, you're using I think a huge fly rod and bigger flies, and it's actually hard because it's sight fishing. So you see the tarpon rolling in, and you have to actually throw your fly out there and present it very well right in front of them. So it's pretty difficult, because when you see them, you're just like in shock. You kind of freeze a little bit and get a little nervous, so you got to be on your game. So a couple beers actually helps loosen you up a little bit too.
Well, no, that's great, and I don't know that I'm going to get my wife tarpon fly fishing anytime soon, but definitely at least in some of the creeks here, trying out the fly rod. I think that, you know, we've been looking for another activity that we can share as a family away from archery, because it is my business. I have a pro shop. Stepping away from the business mentality and getting out in the outdoors and experience something else, I think fly fishing is a great outlet for that. So I appreciate you coming on and having a woman's insight on the natural born hunter, because like Will said, we've yet to have any lovely ladies on the show.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, hold on now. I have some questions.
Okay, sorry, Will.
It's not that easy. I'm going to try to do everyone out there a favor. What would you say, what would you recommend maybe to somebody in Phil's position or my position who wants to get their significant other involved in the sport that, you know, maybe we wouldn't think of as men, because, you know, I see, say I have a square peg and I see a round hole, I'm just going to beat the shit out of it until it fits in that round hole. You know, maybe you know some maybe you could give us some advice, some words of wisdom that would help us get them to share something we're passionate about.
Well, I'm definitely sure. Just be patient. Patience is the key, because when I was just, I'm still learning how to fly fish and trying to get my cast down. Just be patient. Jordan has been very patient with me. And I hope, you know, your wives, girlfriends, any women out there actually love and embrace the outdoors, first of all. You know, you have to love to be out there and want to be out there. And once you get your first fish on, it's, you know, then you're hooked.
Would you say that's your favorite part about being out there, is getting the fish on the hook? Or is there other things you enjoy as much, or maybe even more than that?
I think it's the whole experience, too. It's being with my husband, you know, enjoying nature, and just being out there and actually doing it on my own.
So I've got a quick question, Will.
Yeah.
Bobby, you mentioned that JP's been great and patient with you as far as teaching. I get a lot of husbands that bring their wives, or men that bring their girlfriends into the shop, and they want nothing to do with teaching their wife because they don't want that tension, or, you know, they're not patient, let's say. Have you ever had any other coaching outside of your husband, or has it been pretty much him with the fly fishing?
It's just been him and just teaching myself as well. You know, me being a woman, you don't see many women fly fisher women out there. So for me, it's actually a huge challenge, and, you know, I want to do really well at it, and I want to be better, and hopefully someday I'll, like, make it like JP has, you know. I want to get some spotlight, too.
Hey, you're already on the podcast. It doesn't get much bigger than this.
That's it.
So when he said, hey, when did he start taking you fishing when you guys were dating, or was it, you know, right away or later on into, say, the courtship that JP was like, well, I'm a little, I'll say, obsessed with fishing. Would you like to go with me? Or was it like make or break, like, listen, you have to know this about me when we start out. If you don't fish, I'm going to either be gone a whole lot or this may not work out.
No, it's when we first met, he knew, I told him I loved to fish. We hit it right off, right from the beginning. But I was a spin rod fisherwoman, not a fly. I've never held a fly rod at all, never even tried it. So it wasn't, you know, I already liked fishing so much. So I just grabbed his fly rod and started casting out in the front yard. And he set up hula hoops for me to try to get the fly into each hula hoop. And it was frustrating at first because it's hard. You know, it's your back cast, and it's not easy. And me, I was played college softball, and my problem is I was a shortstop, so I have to get the ball in quick. Well, I'm trying to cast like I'm throwing a softball, and I'm you know, I don't let my back cast go back far enough, so that I'm not letting the line all the way out, and then I'm trying to hurry up and cast it. So that's my problem. That's my biggest flaw right now. So I'm trying to overcome that. But it's not easy. Jordan's been very patient, and a lot of people have said that, you know, your spouse should not teach you because it's going to be crazy. But he's actually been good, and a couple of his friends actually, you know, they're in the boat too, and they're trying to tell me stuff, and I'm trying to listen to Jordan, I'm trying to listen to his friends, and it's kind of like chaotic. Like the other day, we're in the drift boat down on Hinkley Reservoir, and his friend Smitty's telling me, oh, well, you know, you just gotta shoot it out faster, you know, your back cast, and he's back drinking a couple beers, and Jordan's telling me to look back. Bobby, just watch and see the line, you know, just look back. And then Smitty moved in the boat, and I fell right on my ass. And Jordan tried to catch me, but I'm all into it, though. I'm watching my back cast, and I'm like, I want to be good. I want to be really good at this. And it was just hilarious.
So even falling down, you're like, forget this. I'm still catching this fish.
No, I'm still – because you see fish rising everywhere, and your heart's pumping, I'm like – I need to make a good cast and present this fly very well. And if you don't, you lose out, you know, because then there's another fish rising right behind the boat. You know, it's crazy. It's a little chaotic sometimes, but it's amazing.
Now would you say it's harder while Smitty's in there rocking the boat, drinking beers? You know, is that part of the challenge, maybe?
Yes, Smitty is a big, big guy. He likes to drink his beer, and I'm trying to perfect my cast, and he shook the boat, and I went right on my ass. Because I'm looking back trying to perfect it. It was hilarious, though.
So one thing I've kind of learned in this podcast – because I'm, of course, still learning a lot about fly fishing, is beer can either enhance your fly fishing experience or it can knock you on your ass.
Very true.
Another one of those moments where if the camera would have been properly placed, it would have been priceless, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I've actually seen Smitty, and she's right. He's not ballerina size, we'll say. If... Where is your favorite – so your favorite place to fish is the Keys. Where would you say your favorite place is locally? Would you go stream, lake, small stream, big stream? Does it matter? Or, hey, wherever the fish are rising, that's where you want to be.
Well, I have to get my cast down a little bit better. So I would say in a pond or a lake. We've been fishing up north, like Fourth Lake, Racket, the Racket River, and that's been really good too. But the smaller streams, I haven't tried to tackle those yet. I'm trying to learn my cast better because I don't want to be getting stuck in the trees or hook Jordan, you know. Don't want to do that.
You don't want to hook his nose?
No.
Maybe. It builds character.
You've turned out all right.
Okay. So you would agree then that starting out on a lake or smaller pond is an easier start just because there's less, assuming
less
you
obstacles.
Get in the water. Exactly, yeah. That's how I started when I was learning. It was definitely get away from everything else and start short and just get the cast, you know, get your cast okay at a shorter distance and then kind of progress. But I might end up knocking off the dust off my old gear and getting the wife out in the front yard and see if she takes any interest to it.
Yeah, get her out there. Set up those hula hoops.
Yeah, that's the other thing. The hula hoop idea, Phil. I would love to see pictures of you out there with your son or your wife, you know, casting into the hula hoops.
I might have to have another hula hoop around the waist and show you that, you know, I have a little rhythm too, Will.
You got the rhythm?
I'm okay, man. I'm all right.
I would love to see it. Make the video. You don't even have to share it on the Natural Born Hunter site. You can keep that for championship bow hunting. You know, I don't mind on that. I'm sure it'll drive people, you know, straight to the site. But I am willing, you know, out of the kindness of my heart to say, Phil, take this content gold and run with it.
You know, I'll do my best, but I think you in those tight pants, Will, might actually put it over the top if we got you hula hoop.
In tights? Hula hoop.
Hey, you know, you like to sport the tights, right?
I'm telling you right now, if you make a video of you hula hooping while your son's fly fishing in the background into hula hoops, I will do a hula hooping video in tights.
We'll have to work on that. That's definitely something we'll work on.
Oh, I got moves. I got moves for days in the hoop. He used to call me the hoop master back in college. I was part of a hoop troop. Didn't even know the skills I got.
Now we're going down the rabbit hole. Sorry, Bobby.
That's all right.
You come along with us when we just start going off on a tangent, but it happens from time to time.
We've been known.
Yeah.
What would you say to women out there whose husbands are trying to get them to participate in a sport like fly fishing?
I would just get them out there. Basically, just watch at first. And then, actually, how my husband really got me into it was we were down in Isla Mirada, Florida. It was 1 a.m. in the morning underneath a bridge. And
All right. So, isn't that how police blotters start?
Yeah. And we met up with a bartender at Hawks K at the resort we were staying, and he said, "Oh, there's tarpon coming in with the tide." So he threw the fly out there, and I'm like, "You're not going to catch anything." Sure enough, the second cast, he gets a tarpon. Tarpon's jumping out of the water, and Jordan's fighting the fish for a while. And then Jordan's like, I'm going to pop him off. You know, we're going to lose them. I'm like, no, you're not. And then I was like, give me the fly rod kind of thing. Like, I'm going to get this fish in no matter what.
Stand back, Nancy. Boy, this fish is mine.
It was crazy because when he gave me the fly rod, I'm like, there's no fish on here. I'm like, we're stuck on the bottom. He's like, no, there's a fish on there. And I pumped him a little bit. I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to get this fish in. I'm shaking. My adrenaline is going. It was just amazing. So when I had the fly rod in my hand, it's like the fish gave up. And I got hooked into fly fishing. That's exactly how I got hooked. I'm like, I need to learn how to do this because this is amazing.
You know what? I've actually talked to Jordan privately, and it was a very similar story. He just gave up.
Yeah, the tarpon totally gave up as soon as I grabbed the fly rod. It was crazy.
Yeah, he knew what was going on, right? He knew his boss.
Yeah, he said, "There's no way I'm coming to that ugly dude, but this pretty lady, I don't mind one bit."
So when is the time of year you guys actually go down there? What's the best time of year in the Keys?
Well, I would say end of April, going into May. It's the Palola worm hatch. They're worms actually that are in the sand, and they actually hatch in May. Like you never know when it's going to happen. It's all the guides down there are always talking. They're like, "Oh, it's got to be temperature. Has to be just right, you know," and it always happens in May, so you have to be right down there. So it's crazy because all the boats line up by the bridges and all these tarpon, it's like a tarpon aphrodisiac. They go insane. They're jumping out of the water, going crazy, and you throw your fly out there, you'll catch tons. I've never been down there for that, but we've been down there in May, and we were not lucky enough to be there for that, but we watch it all the time. We watch all the DVDs on tarpon. So hopefully next year I'll be lucky enough to be down there for it.
What is an average tarpon weigh?
They get up to like 200. Yeah, they get up about to 200 pounds.
That's
crazy.
It's like Will flopping in the water.
They are huge. You see them in the water, you could actually like ride on them. It's like crazy. They're huge.
I'm gonna tell you right now, Phil, I'm not getting excited over any worms on the beach, though.
No, me either.
So,
dang, I didn't know they were that big.
So, because when you said, I don't know anything about saltwater fly fishing. When you said, you know, I thought I was stuck on the bottom, that would make sense because you're accustomed to, you know, trout or bass or, you know,
right. All
these cold water fish up here. You know, a 200-pound fish, that's going to feel like you're stuck on the bottom.
Yeah, it depends, too. Like, if you have light tackle, they're not going to really jump out of the water and give you a crazy fight. But if you're with the heavier duty tackle, then they're going to, like, fly out of the water. But this one, the tide was coming in, and he started going underneath the bridge, and there was a lot of line out, so it was pretty difficult. But hand the fly rod over to the chick over here, and they'll just give up.
Just like JP, I can see the defeat in his eyes now. Poor guy. I know, Phil, you have to make an airport run.
I'm going to have to cut out here shortly, but I've got about 10 or so minutes left.
Yeah, so minutes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, should we start winding down then, or you got some more questions?
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
No, I'm good. I'm excited. Like I said, hearing you, Bobby, talk about your excitement and your passion for what you do with your husband is great, because, you know, I started getting my wife into archery and bow hunting a little bit when we had two kids, and she kind of put that stuff down, but she's ready again to start getting into, you know, experiencing everything that I get to experience. She says, you know, it's not fair because I still get to live my life while she's taking care of the kids. But, you know, we've definitely restructured our lives a little bit to start getting back outdoors and experiencing things. So I'm definitely going to have her listen into this episode, and hopefully she gets motivated to just to come out and try it out.
Okay, great. Hopefully she doesn't think that I'm a little too stuck on myself.
Oh,
I'm
no.
Definitely not. I'm just, you know, I'm excited. I'm learning and I'm doing well. And my husband enjoys it too, because now we, you know, enjoy the same passion for fly fishing. It's amazing.
Yeah. And that's, and you can tell by hearing you talk and hearing him talk, it's something you guys both share. And I think that's something a lot of couples would love to have. So we appreciate you coming on, and we know you didn't want to, but we appreciate you did. It definitely added some more flavor to the episode today, for sure.
Oh, I'm glad she did. I mean, compared to her, JP was kind of boring. Sorry, JP. I'm also going to ask, would you mind taking my fiance and I fly fishing with you?
There you go. There you go.
I will not be trying to teach her. I would like her to be good at it. all right. That has been this episode of the Natural Born Hunter podcast. We have some cool things in the works. For those of you who don't know, Phil has started a championship bow hunting podcast to, you know, kind of cover the more technical sides of archery and hunting that, you know, really we don't get the time here to cover. And, you know, so that's going to fill in a lot of gaps there. A lot of guys have questions, and, you know, you can send them to Phil over at Championship Bow Hunting, the Facebook page, email him on his website, and, you know, he'll be addressing that, be doing a lot of cool product reviews. So he's got a few episodes of that coming out. Anything you want to say on that, Phil?
No, it's just that. I mean, I've received a lot of messages about a number of different topics, that to set up a video like we were doing stuff before, just primarily video episodes, some topics are harder to cover that way, as opposed to just, you know, telling a quick story about what might be the best way for, you know, whatever the situation is. So it's a shorter podcast. We're talking like 20, 25 minute episodes. I guess some of the guests that we've brought on, some topics have come about. There's some other guests that are definitely, I don't want to say gear geeks or anything like that, but it's just, it might be a little better platform to talk about just the technical side of a few of the bow hunting topics. So yeah, check that out. Championshipbowhunting.com. And that's all I got, man. We're just plugging away. We're trying to spread ourselves as best we can, and continue to, you know, contribute our part as we can.
Also, I've been inspired by, for those of you who aren't members of it, there's a Facebook group called Hunt, Gather, Cook, I believe, and it's a really cool group where people go on and, you know, share recipes and all you know, what they're cooking and all that sort of stuff, and, you know, finding, you know, whether it's mushrooms or, you know, wild veggies or, you know, what game meat they've prepared. A lot of cool stuff on there. And because of that, I'm going to start a Facebook group related to this podcast. So anybody out there, any hunter athletes or, you know, people who are just interested in, you know, fly fishing, archery, hunting, whatever, some of these stuff we talk about on here can, you know, get in there and throw in your own stuff. You know, you guys can kind of ask each other questions or ask the people we've had on questions, you know, interact a little more, make it a little more inclusive, and, you know, just kind of make it a nice sharing of knowledge place to go, as well as, you know, if say somebody's in an area, doesn't know a lot of people or doesn't know anyone who's also into archery or the archery athlete movement, you know, you might be able to find a training partner or a group of guys on there who, you know, share that passion, even if it's for fly fishing, whatever, and, you know, make new friendships. So that's the goal of that, you know, keep it positive, keep it fun. That's the only thing I will say. If you're a shit talker or you're, you know, negative person, I'm going to boot you. That's just how it is. I ain't got time for that.
There right, you Phil? Go. That's it.
No time for that.
No nonsense here. And if you know, if you're new to listening to the podcast, you know, share it with a friend. Tell somebody else about it. You know, we, of course, enjoy having as many listeners as we can and getting the feedback from all you. So, you know, share us on Facebook or check us out directly from our website. You can share a link from there as well. So spread the love, and we'll continue to bring you as best of an episode as we can.
Yeah, and thank you very much to tonight's guests, JP and Bobby Ross. We really appreciate having you guys on tonight. It was a lot of fun, I got to say, for our first fly fishing episode. You know, this is one of my favorites so far.
That's it. So one more time, JP Ross, flyrods.com. And what's the other website? Bob, do you know that one?
It's smallstreamflyfishing.com.
Smallstreamsflyfishing.com. Check it out. Show him some love.
Yeah, he's also on Instagram, Facebook, all those, you know, usual places. Check him out. I think he's under, is it JP Fly Rod? JP Ross Fly Rods. Or if you're interested, you know, in checking out his products, go ahead, hit him up.
That's it.
All right. This has been the Natural Born Hunter Podcast. Wake up, chase dreams, repeat.